The Kabbalah is admittedly, well, it's vast and complicated, spanning the practical, theosophical, and prophetic modes over 800 years through massive volumes composed in half a dozen languages, some of which are so arcane that they're basically idiosyncratic to specific texts. Looking at you, Sefer Zohar, all of which aim to provide comprehensive and systematic solutions to some of the most profound theological questions ever posed. I mean, no big whoop. No aspect of the Kabbalah is simple, and even before taking up the study, the literature just assumes a significant degree of mastery of biblical texts, of the rabbinical literature, including the massive volumes that are the Talmud and the Midrash literature, along with halakha or Jewish law, many of which are all written in Hebrew and Aramaic. Taken from this perspective, it's just really overwhelming. And it's not totally surprising that seasoned Kabbalists take paperback Amazon.com introductions to Kabbalah with a grain of salt, to say the least. So when I get the question, given all of this, where should I begin if I really want to study authentic historical Kabbalah? And I have to admit that I find myself kind of flummoxed by this question. On the one hand, I don't want at all to play into the gatekeeping mentality that if one hasn't mastered all of this and all of that and the other in Hebrew and Aramaic, then you really can't study Kabbalah. I don't really want to give in to that. Nor do I want anyone to think that the very real complexities of the Kabbalah can be, well, honestly, they cannot be condensed into any handy-dandy 150-page book. But neither of these positions strike me as real good-faith answers to the question. So what is my answer these days to the question, where should one start studying Kabbalah in a historically grounded, authentic-to-the-tradition way? Well, I think there might be a perfect little text that answers that exact question in a way that manages to be, one, an actual historical text by a Kabbalist writing for beginning Kabbalists, two, it allows one initial access to other historical Kabbalistic texts, especially the Sefer Zohar, and three, it gives one insight into the very mode of Kabbalistic reasoning, and finally, four, it's easily accessible in both Hebrew and in English, and it's actually in a good translation, it's reliable, and it's affordable. It's even free online. That text is the Or Ne'erav, or the Pleasant Light, composed by the illuminated 16th century Safedian master of Kabbalah, Moshe Cordovero. This rather brief text, composed in a clear, systematic style, outlines why, how, and when one should study Kabbalah, what makes for a good teacher and what makes for a good student, the benefit of such a study, and it introduces and summarizes many of the core metaphysical ideas of Kabbalah, along with providing a really helpful glossary for the beginner to begin to decode some of the classical texts, such as the Sefer Zohar, on your own. All in all, the Or Ne'erav is perhaps one of the best primers for the budding Kabbalist, written by one of the greatest mystical sages in Jewish history. So let's dive into it a bit. If you're interested in Kabbalah, mysticism, magic, alchemy, and the study of the occult, make sure to subscribe to the channel, check out my other content on topics and esotericism, and also, if you want to support the work of providing content like this, accessible, scholarly, and free here on YouTube, which covers a range of topics in esotericism, I'd hope you consider supporting my work on Patreon or perhaps with a one-time donation. You can find those links below, and I really do appreciate your supporting the channel. It makes all of this work possible. But now let's turn to Moshe Cordovero's introduction to the Kabbalah, the Or Ne'erav, or the Pleasant Light. I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and welcome to Esoterica, where we explore the arcane in history, philosophy, and religion. By the middle of the 16th century, the Kabbalah had truly come into its own. Not only that, but following the genocidal edict of the Alhambra Decree of 1492, which expelled hundreds of thousands of Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, Kabbalah had developed a new center, the Galilean town of Safed or Tzfat. Following the conquest of the region by the Ottomans under Selim I, Selim the Grim, a positively metal name, whose father, by the way, was Bayezid II, who doesn't get nearly the credit he deserves for personally saving tens of thousands of Iberian Jews following that 1492 Alhambra decree, the otherwise sleepy town of Safed would grow into the central crucible for the development of the Kabbalah for a few distinct reasons. The first is simply material. The town was on the made trade and postal artery to Damascus and a central player in the regional linen industry. In fact, an Ottoman-era fullery can still be visited in Tzfat at this day, along with a relatively peaceful Ottoman authority, which was highly tolerant of the Jewish population there, along, of course, with the actual and mythical historical connection to the Kabbalah. As you probably know, the Sefer Zohar, despite being a composition of the 13th century in Spain, is actually set in the 2nd century of Palestine, specifically in the Galilee. Indeed, the graves of several sages associated with the Zohar, most especially the hero of the Zohar, Shimon bar Yochai, is actually located in the vicinity of Tzfat or Safed at Meron. For the Kabbalistically inclined, returning to Safed in the Galilee was something of a homecoming. Further, this is all matched with an acute rise in messianic expectations, profound developments in the systematization of the Kabbalah itself, along with the introduction of new forms of mystical piety in the Safed community. All of this would come together to produce one of the most important intellectual and mystical ferments in Jewish history, maybe even in human history, given the enormous historical impact that Kabbalah has made. One of the true luminaries of this period was Moshe ben Yaakov Cordovero, a Jew of Iberian ancestry, perhaps, although we don't know, but maybe born in and around Safed. Like all learned Jews of his time, Cordovero began his studies in the world of biblical and rabbinical literature before being urged by a mystical voice to turn to Kabbalah at the age of 20 under the tutelage of his father-in-law, Rabbi Shlomo Alkabetz. By 27, Cordovero would compose one of the greatest systematizations of Kabbalah in history, his Pares Romim, or the Pomegranate Orchard. He would also go on to compose a truly monumental commentary on the Sefer Zohar, which runs into over two dozen volumes, and other relatively obscure works, some of which actually remain unpublished to this day. Along with these titanic studies, Cordovero also produced several more accessible works, one on Kabbalistic ethics, the Tomer Devora, or the Palm Tree of Deborah, which has gone on to independent fame and remains a complete classic in the world of Musar, or Jewish ethics. It's going to get its own episode at some point in the future, so don't worry, I'll circle back to it. Further, he and the circle around his teacher, Shlomo Alkabetz, would pioneer novel customs such as all-night study sessions, taking to the fields to greet the Sabbath bride. This custom would become the Kabbalat Shabbat service that if you've ever been to a synagogue on a Friday night, you've probably experienced. And the practice of gerushim, or exiles, where he would roam barefoot in the summer as an act of asceticism through the land, imitating the exiled Shechinah, or divine presence, in which he received mystical revelations along the way. Though the star of this episode is his introduction to the Kabbalah more generally, the Or Ne'erav, or the Pleasant Light. First published in 1587 by his son Gedalia, the Or Ne'erav is a brief guide for the beginner looking to study Kabbalah. It systematically defends the study of Kabbalah, describes what, how, and when to study, how to pick a good teacher, some general study tips, a sustained summary of Kabbalistic theosophy, at least according to Cordovero, and especially focusing on the procession and relations of the Sefirot, or the divine emanations, along with a really helpful glossary for decoding other Kabbalistic texts, especially the Sefer Zohar. All in all, it's a compact, clear, and genuinely helpful guide for anyone wanting a historically authentic starting point for the study of Kabbalah. But hold on. It's kind of strange, isn't it? Isn't the Kabbalah inherently esoteric, the carefully guarded secrets of the rabbinical elite? Kinda. And this gives us another insight into Curtivero's life and times. Recall earlier when I said that messianic and redemptive expectations were greatly heightened in the aftermath of the exile from the Iberian Peninsula? Remember that part from earlier? Well, the unveiling of the Kabbalah was thought to play a central role in the process of messianic redemption. So much so that rather than being hidden away, there was an active push during this period to popularize these previously highly esoteric concepts. Indeed, Cordovero's work, especially the publication and composition of the Tomer Devora and the Or Ne'erav, have to be understood as part of this popularization of Kabbalah in the service of ushering in the redemptive messianic age. In fact, this next wave would continue for the entire next century, eventually giving rise to, and to some degree underwriting, the messianic pretender, Shabbatai Tzvi. In fact, it would be in the aftermath of that disaster that strictures would again be imposed upon the dissemination of Kabbalistic ideas, strictures which have, as all such strictures, only really enjoyed mixed success. I mean, you're watching a video about Kabbalah. So the Or Ne'erav has to be understood not only as a Kabbalistic primer, but also as Cordovero doing his part to usher in the Messianic Age. Thus, his genius is not only as a great systematizer of Kabbalah and history, at least I think he was the best. You Lurianic people can come at me, bro. In the book, The Pardes Ramim, but also to produce such an inviting and accessible starting point for the beginner. I think one mark of genius is to have such an elite understanding while steering clear of much in the way of, well, elitism. And I think Cordovero truly accomplishes that in these texts. So let's take a short tour of the Or Ne'erav, or The Pleasant Light, which begins with a positively scathing attack on those that shun the study of Kabbalah. And when I mean scathing, I mean Cordovero openly accuses them of disrupting the flow of divine energy through the Sefirot, thus impeding redemption itself. And he says it would be better off if such people just were never even born. I mean, damn, this coming out swinging. So let it be known, Cordovero got hands, y'all. He then proceeds in the next few chapters to derive proof texts to establish that, you know, those that shun the Kabbalah are nothing short of sinners, actively working against the divine and preventing redemption for the rest of us. Thanks, guys. These first few chapters also give the reader their first real chance to wet your palate in Kabbalistic theosophy, but also in the general mode by which Kabbalistic arguments are established through proof texting. So immediately one gets a sense of what's at stake in Kabbalah. Well, nothing short of the final redemption of reality, but also the methodology of establishing these kinds of truths through exoteric and esoteric argumentation, employing a range of Jewish scriptures, especially the Sefer Zohar. He divides these redemption-blocking, shunning people into three groups, those that deny that there's any esoteric dimension to the Torah at all. He thinks these people are just basic, simple-minded morons. Second group of people are those that think that such esoteric dimensions do exist, but they put off such study, arguing that not until they've mastered every other form of knowledge under the sun, from the Talmud to astronomy, should they ever attempt to study Kabbalah. Here, Cordovero just argues that the perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the good, and that given the stupendous metaphysical power of Kabbalistic study, one must get the best foundation you can and, well, get to it. Start studying as soon as you can. Study the Kabbalah. We got redemption here. Folks, we got to do this. Finally, there are those that argue that such studies will lead one to heresy, especially without a wise teacher. Again, Cordovero here is immensely practical. Wise teachers of Kabbalah were rare then, now, and he argues that it's better to learn on one's own rather than not learn at all, waiting around for some teacher, even if that leads to incorrect ideas at first. Even if it kind of leads to heresy at first. In fact, he actually takes it that serious study will ultimately be guided by nothing short of divine aid. God will come help you out, and that's certainly better than to have no teacher than a bad one. I mean, with no teacher, you kind of get the divine to help you, and yeah, that ain't nothing. But about poor and false teachers. Of course, Cordovero acknowledges that the study of Kabbalah can lead a person to heresy, but this really concerns him more about teachers than about students, and the distinction here is pretty important. While a student may learn something incorrect or come to a heretical position or learn things poorly, they can still be corrected through more study or a better teacher. But a teacher who arrogantly thinks they've got it all figured out really causes significant damage. Thus, study should be encouraged, but we should be suspicious of so-called teachers and vet them accordingly, especially ones that put themselves beyond reproach, claim to have all the answers, or refuse to be corrected by a wiser teacher. But how can a beginner recognize such a false teacher of Kabbalah? Cordovero notes that any teacher of Kabbalah should be skilled in dialectic or appeal pool. They should be able to make logical arguments and defend them logically and publicly. Secondly, any such teacher should have a firm foundation in classical biblical and rabbinic literature, obviously in the original languages. And finally, and in some sense maybe even most importantly, they should be learning and teaching Kabbalah for the sake of the redemption and not, never, for the sake of their own pride, vainglory, or ego. Failure of any of these three criteria means that that person should be disregarded completely as a teacher. As you might imagine, Cordovero doesn't have much kind to say at all about these so-called teachers. In fact, he likens them to the hideous demonic klipot, the husks of reality left over in the residue of creation. While real trees bear fruit, these wretched teachers only grow evil husks, thus spreading their corruption throughout reality. We're also told that teachers must be really careful in selecting students because selecting the wrong people is, quote, like revealing the genitals of the Torah to the sons of the demoness Lilith, as the Zohar has it and as Cordovero lays it out. But the good thing is that such klipotic teachers don't really exist anymore, certainly not on the internet, right? Alright, evil teachers aside, after establishing this defense of the study of Kabbalah and slamming those as klipotic who shun or falsely teach it, Cordovero goes on to show that such study is actually a duty on those capable of undergoing it. In fact, he really leans heavily here on Maimonides. This also really reveals a rather lovely marriage of the more rational Guide of the Perplexed and the more mystical, much more mystical teachings of the Kabbalah. Indeed, only the study of Kabbalah for Cordovero actually and fully answers the riddles of both creation and the obscurities around Jewish law. There's a lot of obscurities there. Something which philosophy just can discuss and maybe aptly discusses it, but it cannot on its own solve those dilemmas. Thus, the Kabbalah and philosophy work together to provide a comprehensive vision of why reality is the way that it is, but also how we should conduct ourselves in righteousness in this reality to redeem it. Here, ethics and metaphysics are really interestingly combined. And again, for folks interested in that angle of Cordovero's thought, you gotta check out his Tomer Devora, The Palm Tree of Devora, Again, I'll be circling back to it in a future episode. Mystical ethics is. It's neat. Now that he's established that we should study and why, now comes the how and the when of study. Here, things are marked by a combination of fear and joy, a kind of radical humility, but also bravery in the hopes of securing mystical wisdom and doing your part in the process of the greater redemption. Cordovero notes that one should avoid books purposely written to obscure their meaning. He simply has no time for obscurantism. Too much is at stake. Such books filled with riddles and metaphors are just meant to puff up the pride of the author, confusing the reader in the interest of making the author seem more wise and more enlightened than they probably are. Again, Cordovero links clarity with piety and wisdom. Again, the point of the Kabbalah for Cordovero is ushering in the final redemption of reality, not showing off how smart you are with flowery, dense, and opaque writing. Hey, continental philosophy, y'all listen to this? Heidegger, Deleuze, y'all out there? Listen to my buddy Cordovero. So, where to start? Cordovero actually provides a kind of preliminary reading list, zeroing in on specific sections of the Sefer Zohar with a foundation in the Sefer Yetzirah and the Sefer Bahir. Now, if you're curious about those texts, I've actually done an episode on them. You can dig into those topics in the cards above. Now, interestingly enough, Cordovero seems to think that the Zohar on the sections of Ruth and on Lamentation actually predate the corpus of the Zoharic literature. And even more interesting, he seems to have access to Zohar on Esther, which is no longer extant. No one seems to have ever seen this aside from Cordovero, and it's kind of unusual that he mentions it. Further, he also encourages the study of Ma'aseh Bereshit and Ma'aseh Merkavah, or the mystical accounts of creation and the mystical journey to the divine throne. These, of course, are pre-Kabbalistic forms of Jewish mysticism, which actually date to the late classical period. Again, you can check out my episodes on those topics in my playlist on Kabbalah if you're curious to learn more about them. Cordovero urges the beginner to skim through a text at first, taking notes along the way. But then they should take additional passes with greater and greater concentration and devotion, especially for difficult passages. According to him, such passages will become clear with, well, intense devotion to the text, with God literally rewarding the student through divine apperception of the material. He argues that one should begin one's studies at the age of 20. That's the same age that Cordovero himself began to study Kabbalah, with the ideal time to study being after midnight until dawn, on the Sabbath, on holidays, especially Shavuot, and most especially inside the Sukkah during Sukkot. Now, there's some complicated stuff here to unpack. If you're watching this video, you've probably heard that there's an interdiction on learning Kabbalah prior to being 40, being married, being educated, etc., etc. Well, that's kind of true. This is actually grounded in Pirkei Avot 5, where Yehuda ben Tema lays out something like a life plan. He says at 5 years of age, you should study scripture. At the age of 10, you should study the Mishnah. At the age of 13, you're subject to the commandments. You become a bar mitzvah. At 15, you begin the study of the Talmud. At 18, you get married. Seems young. At the age of 20, you're out there working. At 30, you have the peak of your strength. At 40, you achieve wisdom. At 50, you're able to give advice or counsel. At the age of 60, you've reached old age. At 70, that's the fullness of years. At 80, you achieve a kind of mystical strength. At 90, you have a bent over body. At 100, you're as good as dead and completely gone out of the world. I'm not kidding, it actually ends like that. The Kabbalists took this at the age of 40 that one achieves Binah, and given one's previous education on biblical and rabbinical foundational texts, only then could one get ready to take up the study of Kabbalah. Generally speaking, this position held and still holds, but again, given the messianic fervor of Cordovero's day, they were a bit more eager to get people, well, studying Kabbalah. These rules were the sake of education and not for the sake of making rules, and thus they could be bent a little. Cordovero started at 20. Though he does still state that getting married is still a prerequisite for studying Kabbalah, having a righteous conduit for one's sexual desires was seen as a necessary precondition for focusing one's attention on the sacred marriage of Tiferet and Malchut, the Hieros Gamos of Israel and the divine, the physical and supernal world, rather than thinking about booty. Also, that studying from midnight until dawn, or even multi-day all-night study sessions, the most famous of which became the custom of studying all night on Shavuot, became a staple of Tiferet spirituality, mostly underwritten by the novel rise in the consumption of coffee. Coffee became all the rage at this time and really helped them stay up all night. Interestingly enough, a similar trend actually took hold at the exact same time with our Muslim brothers over there, the Sufis, also drinking a lot of coffee, spinning around, staying up. Coffee aside, for Cordovero, the advantages of Kabbalistic study were patently clear. It, well, speeds up the process of redemption. There's always that. It assures one a place in the world to come. It allows one to merit the most glorious death possible, the death by divine kiss. It allows one's soul to cling to the upper worlds, even in this lifetime. You get accompanied by angels and the souls of passed away righteous people. It elevates this generation to the righteousness of the generations past. It removes false and idolatrous anthropomorphic conceptions of the divine. Note there, it's a bit like Maimonides. It facilitates proper understanding of the Torah and its laws, and even allows one's prayers to rise up through the registers of reality, unimpeded by the evil Klipot, whose sinister gravitation seeks to bind the world in eternal darkness. You get to bypass the Klipot. Thus, the study of Kabbalah links one with the divine realm. It removes the dross of Klipotic impurity, and it accelerates the process of metaphysical redemption more generally. For Cordovero, it's nothing less than the final key to redemption. Studying Kabbalah will ultimately usher in the perfection of reality. So, to get you started on this, the final sections of the Or Ne'erav form a summary of Kabbalistic metaphysics as they occurred, specifically the procession and development of the Sefirot, as further detailed in his Pardes Ramamim. In fact, it's really just a kind of summary of Pardes Ramamim. Now, given this whole section is a summary, I'm not gonna re-summarize it. I'm like 7-Zip or something, I'm not summarizing a summary. But suffice to say, it's one of the most lucid depictions of the inner dialectic of the Sefirot as they proceed from the inner sacred void of Ein Sof, and we interact with them here. The text comes to an end with a final study aid. Cordovero actually mines the Sefer Zohar for the many metaphorical and allegorical names for the various Sefirot and other metaphysical entities of Kabbalistic literature, especially the Zohar. As I'm sure you know, the Zohar is a highly allegorical analysis or midrash of the inner life of the divine, especially in terms of the Ten Sefirot. Of course, the Zohar weaves these allegories using an extremely, extremely polyvalent system of terms, which are positively confusing even for experienced readers of the text. This might be the most difficult aspect of studying the Sefer Zohar. Here, Cordovero does you a solid, and he provides the beginner with something of a mystical dictionary such that one can kind of decode even such a difficult text as the Zohar on one's own. Again, this reveals Cordovero's deep commitment as an educator. Rather than gatekeeping at every turn, he seeks to empower the student with access to the ideas and the text central to Kabbalah with inviting clarity rather than pompous obscurity or self-aggrandizement. He really wants you to take up the study of Kabbalah on your own or with a righteous teacher. While not the most famous text in the history of Kabbalah, the Or Ne'erav is truly a remarkable text, not for its tortured hidden mysteries, but for its welcoming attitude and its transparent invitation to take up the study of Kabbalah for anyone willing to do the work. For this reason, and for all the other ones I've mentioned, I really advise folks interested in starting or restarting their interest in Kabbalah to start their journey with the Or Ne'erav. Further, it's freely accessible in both Hebrew and English online via Safaria, so you can literally read it right now for free in the very reliable edition by Ira Robinson. You can find those links to the text in the description below, and it ain't even published by Brill or nothing. As I mentioned, I'll be coming back to Cordovero's Tomer Devora, the ethical companion to the Or Ne'erav, at some point in the future. Of course, Cordovero would pass into the world to come in 1570 at the young age of only 48. Legend has it that Isaac Luria would arrive in Safed that very day. As he followed the funeral train of Cordovero, Luria is said to have looked to the front of it and seen nothing short than the divine pillar of fire leading the procession to Cordovero's resting place among the saints of Safed. May their merit shield us. It remains a site of sacred pilgrimage to this day. The Kabbalah of Luria would go on, as you know, to eclipse that of Cordovero, but that's a story for another day. Again, I hope you subscribe, check out my other content on topics in esotericism, including a whole 14-part introductory course on the history and development of Kabbalah. And again, I'd hope you consider supporting my work of making scholarly and free content on topics in a pretty vast array of esotericism here on YouTube for free. I hope you consider supporting my work on Patreon or perhaps with a one-time donation. Again, you can find those links below if you're interested. Until next time, I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and thank you for watching Esoterica, where we explore the arcane in history, philosophy, and religion.